Access Cast, an Accessibility initiative, presents Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. Hi, I'm Michael Hinkson, Chief Vision Officer for Accessibility and the author of the number one New York Times bestselling book, Thunderdog, the story of a blind man, his guide dog, and the triumph of trust. Thanks for joining me on my podcast as we explore our own blinding fears of inclusion, unacceptance, and our resistance to change. We will discover the idea that no matter the situation or the people we encounter, our own fears and prejudices often are our strongest barriers to moving forward. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is sponsored by Accessibility. That's ACCESSIBE. Visit www.accessibility.com to learn how you can make your website accessible for persons with disabilities and to help make the internet fully inclusive by the year 2025. Glad you dropped by. We're happy to meet you and to have you here with us. Welcome once again to Unstoppable Mindset. Thanks for joining us wherever you happen to be today. Summer is basically almost here, and that's a good thing. We're supposed to have hot records. Whoa, I can't talk today. We're supposed to have hot weather here in Victorville, California. It's only going to be about 100. And that's just the start. Anyway, I'd like you to meet Alyssa Bartlett, who is a leader in dealing with all things marketing in a lot of different ways. And you're going to learn about that in the course of the day. So Alyssa, thanks for joining us on Unstoppable Mindset.
Hi, Michael. Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Well, it's our honor to have you. Why don't we start a little bit by you discussing kind of your life a little bit, where you came from, you growing up, and all the usual sorts of things so that people can get to know you a little better.
Sure. So I grew up in Oakland, California. I have to say, go Warriors, because my parents are rooting very hard for their basketball team today.
Today could be the day.
Today could be the day. Today hopefully will be the day. So I grew up in Oakland, spent most of my time growing up between Oakland and Berkeley, a little bit of a venture to San Francisco, but not too much. That's considered, you know, the other side of the Bay. So there's kind of a divide there. I went to a university down in San Diego at the University of California, San Diego, where I majored in psychology and human development. I graduated from UCSD in 2004, and I got an amazing job working for a nonprofit called the Center for Creative Leadership. They are a leadership development firm specializing in leadership development training and coaching, and they also do a ton of research and publications around leadership. It was a great place to start my career. I learned a ton and got exposed to a lot of wonderful content and mentors, and that was really great. After being there for 2 years, I took on a role as a consultant, and I was doing supply chain and logistics consulting for Fortnite Inc. And my main client at the time was ProFlowers.com, and that was a really good gig. I had some other clients, including Fox Racing, Burlington Coat Factory, as well as AllClad, which was really fun. We actually got to see how the process that they go through to clad the metals together and create their pots and their pans and everything like that. So that was really fun. I was traveling all over the country for 3 years with that job, then decided I wanted to get off the road. So took on a role working for a small marketing research firm called Market Lab. Market Lab was entirely remote position. So I went from being on the road every week to working from home. And that was, of course, working from home back before it was the cool thing to do as it is today. So I was doing project management, and then I was managing a team of project managers. And then I was managing the whole operation of the company. And then finally, I was doing sales and business development and project direction for the company. So that was great for 10 years. And then I decided that working from home was just too hard on me being the extrovert that I am. And so I wanted to get back to a job where I was going into an office. So I found a company called Improving, and they're a technology management and consulting firm. And they have an office here in Minnesota in Bloomington. So the commute was about 45 minutes for me from Stillwater, but I didn't really mind because I really liked the job and I loved the company. And I was in a sales role. And so after 3 months being at Improving and starting to feel like I was getting the hang of the sales role, the pandemic hit. And so all of a sudden I could no longer meet with people in person. We couldn't hold our in-person events that we would do for marketing. I had to be working from home again rather than going into an office. And it got really hard to do my job. So I struggled through another year or two of that and got to the point where it was just really hard to do a sales job for a company that I was so new to and an industry that I was so new to. And then an opportunity came along for me to do some contract work with a former client of mine. So I mentioned that I had worked at Pro Flowers, and my client there was a man named Curtis McConnell. And he had gone out on his own and started a company called Authentify Art. They're an art technology firm. And what that means is that they have a platform that is used to manage art. It's kind of like Zillow, but for the art world, used to manage art as assets. And you can have a profile of your artist and all their artwork, and have upload documents that are all the supporting documents to prove the authenticity of the artwork. And they have a number of other supporting products around that primary platform, including ID tags for art. So these are RFID tags utilizing near field communication or NFC technology, as well as using UHF or ultra high frequency technology. So these tags can be used for tracking artwork, also for doing inventory on a collection of art, and also for providing enhanced digital experiences to go with viewing a physical work of art. We also have an IoT tracker that tracks the environmental conditions around a work of art, including temperature, humidity, light, gyration, air quality, air pressure, and things like that. So it's kind of like a Fitbit for art. And we can use that data to generate alerts that get triggered when something is above or below a certain threshold. So if it's getting above 90 degrees, you can have an alert get kicked off that says, hey, there may be a fire. Or if it's getting above 90% humidity, you can have an alert that kicks off that says, hey, there may be a flood or a burst pipe here. And so these are all things that the insurance companies really care about when they're insuring the paintings, because these are all things that will compromise the quality and the value of the work of art.
So what is it that you do relating to that?
I'm serving as the director of product quality. So what that means is I'm responsible for the quality of the products, including the tags and the art tracker, and as well, the platform itself.
So I'm curious, you went to UCSD. I was up the road at UC Irvine, although before you. So how did you get from there and Oakland, California to Minnesota?
Oh, that's a really good question. So during the time that I worked for Market Lab, where I was working from home, I was fortunate enough to have three children. So we had one kid in 2012. And then in 2015, we became pregnant with twins. And so we ended up with three kids, and we were living in a 2-bedroom, 1-bath California bungalow that we were renting. And so looking around at, what there was available for us to buy, the housing market in the Bay Area is just so bonkers that we really didn't feel like we could afford the space that we needed. Meanwhile, my husband grew up in Minnesota, and we would come to visit his family out here. And I always loved coming out to visit. And so on our last trip, I just said to him, I think we should consider moving back to Minnesota. And he said, well, what do you mean back? You've never lived there. And I said, well, but you know, you lived there and that's like basically the same thing. And I think we should consider moving there. And he was pretty resistant to the idea. You know, he was like, I made it out of California. Why would I want to go back to Minnesota? I mean, I made it out to California. And I said, well, why don't you just look at what we can afford and get back to me? So he looked at houses online. So we were in California at the time. And he looked at houses online. And the third house he looked at was just our perfect dream home. It was the type of house we always talked about wanting, you know, the layout, the location of it, everything was just perfect. And so I found a realtor and I said, hey, I want to buy this house. And the realtor said, great. And my in-laws came and did a tour and they did like a FaceTime tour of it so we could see the house on FaceTime. And they said it looked good. We trust their judgment. And so we made an offer on the house and it was accepted and we moved in and the whole process took less than 2 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
And probably a whole lot more affordable in terms of price.
Per square foot, it was about 1/8 the price of what a home in California would have cost.
Yeah. Which counts for a lot, needless to say.
Yeah. So we basically got 3 times the space that we had for a third of the price.
And you're happy back in Minnesota with all the cold weather and the snow and all that?
Yeah, I love it. Having grown up not really having seasons, I do like the seasons and the changing of the seasons. It makes me feel like I live in a completely different place every 3 months. So I think that's really fun. And right now we've got gorgeous weather. It's in the 70s or maybe it's up to the 80s now. You know, beautiful green and lush and, you know, water everywhere. And, you know, it's not the California desert, but we're getting close to California temperatures now. And it's really nice.
Yeah, but this too shall pass.
it sure will. And it'll get cold again. But the snow can be fun, too. We like to ski and do other kinds of outdoor activities in the snow, like sledding and building snowmen and having snowball fights.
There you go. Well, you have along the way become sort of active in the whole concept of diversity, equity, and inclusion. How'd that happen?
So growing up in Oakland and Berkeley, I was always exposed to a pretty diverse group of people. So my best friend from elementary school is Black. My best friend from high school is Asian. And I just was always surrounded by people with different backgrounds from me. I was raised Jewish, but I was surrounded by people of all different religious backgrounds and people with, you know, no religious affiliation whatsoever. And I was always just surrounded by diversity. And so I never really thought much about it until, it was about 2017 when we were attending a Unitarian Universalist church and we were exposed to the work of Robin DiAngelo and her work around white fragility. And she was talking about progressives who will look at a situation and say, oh, but I'm not a racist. So, you know, we don't need to talk about this, and kind of shutting down the conversation. And I realized that that's something that I had been doing. And then I was exposed through a gentleman that I met on Facebook in one of these sort of progressive groups, Facebook groups. I met Merjan Sadar, and he said to me, you know, I asked him if he considered himself a progressive, and he said, I don't think that that's really very well defined. I am an anti-racist. And I said, tell me more about being an anti-racist. And he said, well, it's not just enough to say I'm not racist. You have to stand for something and be specifically anti-racist. And so that really inspired me to take a more active role in specifically being anti-racist, not just I am not racist. So I started attending events that were put on by organizations that are in the diversity, equity, and inclusion activism space. So there's an organization that's newer to Minnesota called the Center for Economic Inclusion. And I was actually at the kickoff for their organization, the kickoff event, which was really interesting here in Minnesota. And there's some other organizations that I've been exposed to through the Minneapolis Chamber of Commerce that are, doing this kind of DEI activism work.
How was any of that translated, being prejudiced about this kind of subject? How was that translated for you in terms of ever dealing with disabilities? Because typically in the diversity world, disabilities are left out. We talk about differences, we talk about race, we talk about gender and other kinds of things. But when it comes to dealing with disabilities, those of us who are involved in that tend not to be included, which really tends to be a problem. So how do we deal with that?
That's a really good question. And I think that part of it is that oftentimes with a disability, you can't see it. So sometimes you can, right? So you can see race and ethnicity, you can see gender. There are some disabilities that you can see, when we're talking about kind of physical disabilities and limitations. But there are a lot of disabilities that you can't see, whether it's a mental disability or a chronic pain or, other types of disabilities. And so I think when you can't see it, it gets harder to measure and it gets harder to take into account. But there's I think that your organization, for example, is a really good example of a company that does cater to inclusion around all different types of disabilities and making websites accessible to people with many different types of disabilities, including disabilities that you can't necessarily see.
Well, and yeah, that's true that we deal with a number of disabilities which may not be visible, but even taking into account the visible disabilities, I have, for example, attended meetings on diversity and have actually been asked to speak at meetings on diversity. The problem is that when the conversations are occurring and they're discussing diversity and such things, disabilities are still left out. And so we can get granular and talk about specific disabilities, but it really doesn't matter. We are still, as a class of people, not included in the conversation pretty much. And that tends to be the problem. The unemployment rate among most persons with disabilities, and I'll deal with physical disabilities, whether it be people in wheelchairs, people who happen to be deaf, people who happen to be blind, the unemployment rate is close to 70%. And it's not that we can't do the work, it's that we're not given the opportunity because people think we can't. And in the whole diversity movement, we get left out. And that's sort of the frustrating part. How do we get the movement to truly be inclusive? Because you can't be inclusive if you're going to leave segments of the group out.
Well, I think you said the key word there, which is inclusion. So it's not just about diversity, which tends to be more associated with skin color and gender and the sort of visible things that you can see. It's about making yourself and your organization be inclusive of all. And that's why when I was the VP of volunteer engagement for AMA Minnesota, that's American Marketing Association, not American Medical Association. American Marketing Association Minnesota chapter, we were doing our strategic plan for 2020, and we were focusing on being more inclusive. And we purposefully used the word inclusion rather than the word diversity, because it is more broad in its definition. And so how do I personally handle it? So it's not just enough to say I treat everyone the same regardless of their abilities or disabilities or skin color or gender. But what I actually do is I seek out people who are different from me whether it's different skin color, different age, different gender, different religious background, different culture or career, or different able-bodiedness. I seek out people who are different from me, and I cultivate those relationships, and I get to know them and learn about, you know, who they are and where they're from and their background and, you know, that sort of thing. And so I maintain a very inclusive group of friends and colleagues and acquaintances.
And you actually said something that sort of verifies something that I have thought, which is diversity, and the way I put it, has been warped not to include disabilities. You're right. It generally includes or involves people of different races, different genders, and sexual orientations, and so on. But it doesn't include disabilities. And the fact is, it should, because it should. We're still talking about differences, but it doesn't. And that's what really gets to be part of the issue. And so I'm seeing a lot of people who talk about inclusive today and inclusion today, but they're not, because they're still doing the same thing. It still comes down to not including persons with disabilities. And the reality is, unless we change the language, and I sure hope we don't, inclusion and inclusiveness means inclusion, and you can't leave people out. But the problem is that as a society, we still haven't gotten to the point where we accept persons with so-called disabilities as equals. And disability is an unfortunate term, but it's the best there is. We can't, I don't know another term to use. Differently abled is horrible, which a lot of people have tried to use, but we're not differently able. We're just as able in the ways that we always have been. We do it differently, but so do a lot of people. Short people do things differently than do tall people, but it doesn't make them different or less equal. So it is a challenge. And somehow we really need to change the conversation to truly be more inclusive right from the outset. And that's the thing that I think is still lacking a great deal.
I agree with you. And I think that that's the importance of podcasts like this one, where you're talking to a lot of different types of people about these concepts, and you're making sure that the conversation does include those with disabilities into the inclusive and diversity frameworks.
We do talk to all sorts of people, even if they like the Warriors as opposed to the Lakers, but it's okay. Oh, sports is fun. But you know, and I asked the question because I was curious to get your responses, and they really do sort of validate the thoughts that I and then others have had. And it is also important for people like you who are out in the world and dealing with a lot of these things to find ways to broaden people's eyes about inclusion and diversity. And hopefully that will happen. Well, you said you've been doing work with the American Marketing Association. Love to learn more about that.
Yeah. So AMA Minnesota has been around for about 40 years. And when the George Floyd murder took place in May of 2020. There was a big uprising here, you know, that was sort of, Minnesota was sort of ground zero for this swell of activity. And we, among the AMA board, were talking about this a lot. And what we recognized was that if you look at our chapter, it doesn't necessarily reflect the makeup of our profession as a whole. Most of the people who are involved with our chapter are white, and most of the people who are involved with our chapter are women. So we were mostly attracting white women to our events. Interestingly enough, the panelists at our events were mostly white men, despite the fact that our membership was mostly white women. Our panelists were still mostly white men. And I think that's just a holdover from previous eras where white men were seen as the sources of information and knowledge. So we recognized that we had a problem in that we weren't reflecting the larger community of marketers that are in Minnesota. And we had some data around that. And, you know, it's a much more diverse population than what we had. We had some diversity in terms of industry and experience level and education and that sort of thing, which was great, but we didn't have a good level of diversity when it came to skin color. And we didn't have a good level of a reflective mix when it came to gender of our panelists and our speakers. So we started paying attention to that, and we started partnering with other organizations in the Twin Cities that could bring, you know, get us in front of a different audience. For example, there's an organization called Black Bloggers and Creatives of Minnesota. And we partnered with them to put on events and invite their membership and our membership and sort of do some cross mingling there. We also took a look at our panelists and made a specific effort to make the panelists be more diverse. And of course, here again, I'm using that word diversity, and I'm using that on purpose because we were definitely focused on what the panels looked like. Because that's one way to do, it's not the only way to do diversity and inclusion, but that's one way to do it. So I'll give you an example. We have a signature event that we do every year, and we call it Ad Bowl. So we do this event the day after the Super Bowl, and it's all about the ads that were shown in the Super Bowl that year. So in 2019, the Ad Bowl panel was made up of 3 white men and 1 woman of color. It was a great panel. I learned a lot. It was fun and funny, but it was definitely skewed. And so in 2021, when we did Ad Bowl, we were very conscientious to pull in panelists who looked different from each other. And so that year we had 2 white males, 1 white female, and 2 women of color who were female, obviously being women. And so we had a much more diverse panel, and the conversation was richer and brought in more, you know, different perspectives on the ads. And of course, that year, diversity and inclusion was a really big part of the Super Bowl ads, given the groundswell of activity through the Black Lives Matter movement. So it was great to have a panel that was really reflective of experts in this field and people who have lived experiences that are related to that content. So I was really proud of the work we did around that.
Was Ad Bowl virtual in 2021?
It was.
I'll bet. Virtual
in 2021. So it's actually been virtual. We haven't yet done an in-person one. So my expectation is that next year it will go back to in-person, which is really fun. But being virtual, we actually used it to our advantage because we were able to get some panelists that didn't live in Minnesota, thereby diversifying the panelists even more so.
Well, hopefully in the future, they'll add people with disabilities. You know what, depending on who you listen to, whether it be the CDC or other places, the population of persons with disabilities in the United States is anywhere between 21 and 25%. So it's a pretty substantial group, and hopefully they will also get more involved in the whole marketing world. And that might be a fun thing to add to the mix.
I think that's a really excellent point, Michael. I'll have to take it back to them.
I think it'd be a fun thing to explore. Yeah. What happens at the Ad Bowl?
The panelists all present which one of the ads was their favorite.
Okay.
So we get to watch the ad, and then we talk about it and why was it their favorite. We then do the ad that they liked the least, and we talked about how it might have missed the mark. And then we talk about any other ads or campaigns that were, you know, significant or stood out in a specific way.
We don't discuss the puppy bowl or the kitten bowl.
No, I mean, the only way that would come up if it was tied to some sort of campaign that a brand was running.
Oh, I understand. That's another whole story.
Yeah, indeed it is.
Well, I think you've talked about this a little bit, but you mentioned it as one of the things you wanted to talk about. How do you practice diversity and inclusion in your daily life? I think you touched on that some already.
Yeah, I touched on that a little bit, and that is that I really purposefully seek out people who are different from me. And so that's one way that I do it. I have three boys, and I talk to them about people who are different from them, you know, differently abled or who look different or who, you know, I try to incorporate at a very basic level. I try to incorporate toys and activities that are typically meant for girls. And I'm using air quotes here when I say girls. But my kids are really into My Little Pony, for example, which is something that's, I think, typically targeted towards girls. We do a lot of arts and crafts in our house. So I expose them to things that are geared at a more diverse population. And the another thing that I do is I seek out authors that are like a diverse set of authors and content creators when it comes to things like books and podcasts and articles. Just really seeking out sources of information that have a different background from me.
Well, I'm glad that you really do focus on looking at things that are different than you and people who are different than you, and that you give your children exposure to that at an early age. If we start that earlier, then they'll grow up thinking about that more than if we don't do it at all.
Indeed.
And that's kind of important to do.
Yeah.
So who inspires you?
So I smile when you ask that question, because the person who inspired that question to begin with is a dear friend of mine named Rabia Kuhn. And Rabia works and lives in London. When I met her, we were both living in San Diego. We had both gone to UCSD, and then she worked for Pro Flowers, who, as I mentioned, was a client of mine. Rabia has made her way out to London, and she works full time, but she also has a wonderful podcast called More Than Work. And who inspires you right now is one of the questions that she always asks her guests. And I just love it as a question. And so when you asked me for questions, Michael, I was like, you should ask me this one. So Rabia inspires me because not only does she work full time, actually in a marketing role as well, but she also does this podcast and she does stand up comedy. And to me, those three things are kind of three full-time jobs in and of themselves, and she does all of them. And oh, by the way, she does it with a chronic medical condition. So she's doing all this along with this chronic condition, which if you want to learn more about that, you should go check her out at morethanworkpod.com, where she will talk a little more about that. But she inspires me right now. Another dear friend of mine who inspires me is Rashida Mahane. And Rashida, I met Rashida through LinkedIn, through some mutual LinkedIn connections. And Rashida has a startup in the financial services sector. And my former company, Improving, was running a competition for startups. And so I didn't know Rashida very well, but I knew that she was the CEO of a startup. And so I messaged her one day and I said, hey, you should apply for this pitch competition that we're doing. And she got back to me immediately and said, absolutely, I will. And I said, and hey, you know, I don't know that much about you or what you're doing, but I would love to see your pitch if you would just do it for me. I'm not one of the judges, but I'd love to see it. So we arranged a time for her to do her pitch for me, and it was incredible. And we hit it off right away. And what her app is, it's an app that was originally, she had it geared towards millennial women, and it's a financial management app. to help people not only to improve their financial situation, but also to improve their relationship with money and their behaviors associated with money. So her business sits at the intersection of financial planning and psychology. And I just thought that that was a really interesting way to approach it. And one of the pieces of feedback that Rashida got from the Code Launch people, Code Launch was the name of the competition that she had applied for. One of the pieces of feedback she got was that her product was not specific enough with who she was targeting, because millennial women are a very large group, and it just didn't feel tailored enough to one population. And so she and I had a lot of conversations around this, and I said, well, why don't you tailor it towards African-American millennial women? And she said, well, I don't really know that there's a market for that. I don't, you know, I think that she was just nervous about doing that, and she thought that that would make her market too small. And she said, I'm just going to design it for any millennial woman and, you know, the hope that African-American women get interested in it. And I said, well, I think you're going about this backwards. I think that you should be designing it specifically for African-American women, and other people will be interested in it as well. And I said, design the app that you needed 3 years ago when you had hit rock bottom. Design what you needed then as a single mother, you know, raising her daughter and dealing with financial issues and work issues and all of this stuff. Design the app that you needed. And she was like, you're absolutely right. And that really set her off on this course to develop an app specifically for women of color. And she's really taken off. She's won a bunch more competitions. She applied to Code Launch again the next time it ran and got accepted into the program and got part of her app developed for her for free. And she's just been kicking ass and taking names, and I'm so proud of her. And she's a huge inspiration to me.
That's pretty exciting. It's interesting when you can really have an impact on someone and their attitudes and what they do. I think that it's important that we try to broaden people's horizons. And I say it that way because you broadened her horizons by getting her to focus in on a specific group of people. And I wonder if what you also said is true, which is that others outside of millennial African-American women have gotten interested in her app.
Yeah, they have. And, you know, one of the things that we talked about is I said, you know, it's so often that systems in our country are designed for the majority, the majority group, right? So if that, let's say that it's, you know, the education system, which is primarily designed for white children, and then the minority groups just have to adapt. And I said, you know, don't Black women deserve to have their own financial planning app that's designed specifically for them? I think they deserve that. And, you know, it's not a ton of differences. I'm not saying that African-American women are that much different from white women, but there are some, there are differences there. You know, they're dealing with different challenges and different hurdles, and they really deserve to have something that's designed specifically for them. And the thing is, you can't, you know, paint everyone in the same group with the same brushstroke, and there will be other people who are not necessarily an African-American woman, but maybe they are a single mom, and, you know, maybe this app would be helpful to them too, and it will attract other people in other demographic groups, but to really make it for an African-American woman.
Well, it's also unfortunate that we have to spend so much time recognizing that everyone is different, rather than recognizing that there are so many similarities in all of us, and create products and apps that address all of our issues inside one app. But that isn't the way the world works today.
Things are very specialized. Things are getting very niche. And that's one of the things that we talk about a lot in marketing, is that you really have to get really granular and targeted with your marketing. And sometimes it'll be like a multi-pronged approach where you're going after multiple segments of the population. But a lot of times you're going to segment out the population on something, you know, whether it's race or gender or household income, or there's far more complicated attitudinal segmentations that we I used to do at Market Lab. And you're going to pick one population to target because your product is going to appeal mostly to one specific segment of the population, and that's who you want to target with your advertising and stuff like that.
Even though other markets may very well be able to use the product.
Yep, but those are secondary.
Yeah. Oh, I understand. They're definitely secondary, but the hope is, I would think, that they will come along and recognize that maybe this is good for them too.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's just, but you have to start somewhere. And yep. I recognize the value of marketing to a particular group and seeing how that goes. Mm-hmm. And maybe over time, we will recognize that although we have a lot of different groups of people, we don't look enough at the fact that we're a lot more alike than we like to think we are. But right now, we treat everything as granular and as different. And that's probably what we have to do, because otherwise, we'll leave out so many different people.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, totally.
So you, since you brought it up and said that I asked you questions, tell me about the conscious capitalism market or philosophy guide you, and tell me a little bit more about conscious capitalism philosophy.
Yeah, I love talking about conscious capitalism.
I thought you did.
Conscious capitalism is a philosophy that I was exposed to when I was working for Improving. Conscious capitalism is a philosophy and approach to doing business that has four tenets. So the first tenet is higher purpose, and saying an organization has to have a higher purpose beyond just making money. Of course, the organization has to be financially solvent, but that can't be an organization's only purpose. The second tenet is a stakeholder orientation, and that is a stakeholder orientation as opposed to a shareholder orientation. So it's looking at all of your stakeholders, which for sure include your shareholders, but it also includes your customers, your employees, your vendors, your distributors, your suppliers. It can include your community. It could include the environment, and it can include all these things. And you can make business decisions based on any one of those subgroups of stakeholders and have that be a viable business decision, as opposed to making all your decisions just thinking about your shareholders. The third tenet is conscious leadership. And what that is saying is that you are consciously leading the charge within your community to a more conscious way of doing business. And then the last tenet is conscious culture and management, which is saying that, you know, every company has a culture, whether you intend it to have it or not. And so you ought to be intentional about the culture of your company, make it fit with your employees and also with what you do in the world to make it be a really great place to work. And so I think about the concepts of conscious capitalism, you can really apply it to any business, and you can even apply it to something like your household.
And aren't you really describing to a large degree the concept of the entrepreneurial spirit?
I think the entrepreneurial spirit is woven in there, but conscious capitalism is something that can be taken on by any sized company at any stage in their trajectory. Some good examples of companies that embody this philosophy. So Whole Foods is one of them. And in fact, the gentleman who wrote the book is John Mackey, who's the original founder of Whole Foods. And he wrote this book called Conscious Capitalism. Southwest is another really conscientious company that, you know, really thinks about not just their shareholders, but their customers and their employees. So I'm trying to, of course, I'm blanking on all my other conscious capital. I mean, improving. My former company is a conscious capitalism company where they say, yeah, we want to make money. That's a given. We do need to make money, but they also do all sorts of things that are not necessarily making them money, things that even cost them money. For example, improving hosts, local interest groups at their offices to do things like monthly meetings of maybe, you know, the Quality Assurance Professionals Association or Tech Masters, which is like Toastmasters, but for technology. And they don't just provide the space for people to come and convene, but they actually feed people. So they do pizza in the evenings or, you know, coffee and donuts in the mornings. And so they put money into the community because those people are stakeholders to the company.
Right. And that's kind of why I thought of the whole concept of entrepreneurialism, because it really fits very well with that whole concept. If somebody truly has that spirit, it's a lot more than just a product. It's a lot more than making money. It is all about trying to work toward a higher purpose of what effect you're going to have and what you do with the company, what you do to affect the world.
I agree. I think it's a really great way to grow, to start a company and grow a company around a really solid philosophy. And so from that standpoint, I agree that it does really embody the entrepreneurial spirit.
Yeah, we oftentimes lose that spirit as we are in a company and it grows and becomes more successful. We get to focus so much on making money, doing things for our shareholders. And I've been lectured to by many people on many occasions about how, well, our overall arching goal is to just do things for our shareholders. Really? I think that people lose a lot of the perspective when they take that position that made them what they were in the first place.
So
and the whole conscious capitalism idea is certainly a significant part of that.
Yeah, exactly. So the co-author of the book Conscious Capitalism is a professor named Raj Sisodia, and he does research on companies, and he's done research which shows that companies that embrace the conscious capitalism philosophy actually do better financially than companies that don't.
So there you go. It proves the point.
Yeah, it's not just a feel-good philosophy. It's actually a sound business strategy.
And that really is, I think, a most important part of the whole concept is that by definition, the proof is that it not only is a sound business philosophy, it makes for more successful businesses.
Absolutely.
And oftentimes people in dealing with business find that they do better when they recognize that there's more to life than just making an extra dollar.
Yeah, it's true.
Well, this has been fun. And I really have enjoyed having you on, and I look forward to, I'm going to have to go see if I can find the book and read it. And can you give us the name of that again and the authors?
Yep. Conscious Capitalism by John Mackey and Raj Sisodia.
There you go. We're going to have to go find that. Well, this has been absolutely a lot of fun. As I said, if people want to reach out to you and make contact with you or learn more about what you do, how can they do that?
The best way to do it is to find me on LinkedIn. I'm Alyssa Bartlett. And just find me on LinkedIn, connect with me, message me. And, you know, that's how you and I connected, Michael. And
it is.
It's a really great platform.
Oh, LinkedIn offers a lot, and it's been fun to be able to connect with you and to connect with other people. And as I love to say, if I'm not learning from these podcasts, then I'm not doing my job right. When I travel and speak, I always feel that if I'm not learning more than I get a chance to impart, then I'm not doing it right somewhere along the line, because I think that it's important that we all learn and grow.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, thank you again for being here and for being with us and a part of this. I hope that people will reach out and will read the book. I think it sounds like it is something that we should all take to heart. And for all of you, and for all of you listening, please reach out to Alyssa. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach me at michaelhi@accessibe.com or go to our podcast page, michaelhingson.com/podcast, and give us a 5-star rating. We appreciate your ratings and your feedback in all that we do. So it's the way that we get a chance to understand what you want to hear about, and we do our best to make your comments into a real wish that comes true. So thanks very much. And Alyssa, I really appreciate again you being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
You have been listening to the Unstoppable Mindset Podcast. Thanks for dropping by. I hope that you'll join us again next week and in future weeks for upcoming episodes. To subscribe to our podcast and to learn about upcoming episodes, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/podcast. Michael Hingson is spelled MichaelHingson. While you're on the site, please use the form there to recommend people who we ought to interview in upcoming editions of the show. And also, we ask you and urge you to invite your friends to join us in the future. If you know of anyone or any organization needing a speaker for an event, please email me at speaker@michaelhingson.com. I appreciate it very much. To learn more about the concept of blinded by fear, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/blinded by fear. And while you're there, feel free to pick up a copy of my free ebook entitled Blinded by Fear. The Unstoppable Mindset Podcast is provided by AccessCast, an initiative of Accessibe, and is sponsored by Accessibe. Please visit www.accessibe.com. Accessibe is spelled A-C-C-E-S-S-I-B-E. There you can learn all about how you can make your website inclusive for all persons with disabilities and how you can help make the internet fully inclusive by 2025. Thanks again for listening. Please come back and visit us again next week.